It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As we experience unseasonably warm winter conditions in our state, does that mean we could encounter ticks after spending time outdoors? We check in with Lyric Bartholomew, professor in the Department of Pathobiological Sciences at UW-Madison and co-director of its Midwest Center of Excellence for Vector-Borne Diseases. Call in with a question. Add your comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Lyric, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you for having me, as always.
Good morning. So you have started monitoring for ticks earlier than usual. What are you seeing so far?
Right. Well, we work in close collaboration with the Department of Health Services downtown here in Madison. And one of our colleagues went out a couple of weeks ago, actually, to look for ticks when we had some really unseasonably warm days, when it was getting up above 40, even 50 degrees. And he went out to several counties around Wisconsin and did the work we do to look for ticks, which is a little strange, but it may look a little strange, but we go out with a white cloth and drag it behind us on the ground to see if we can find ticks that are out looking to grab onto people or animals. And what he found was that there were quite a lot of ticks actually out and active, even a couple of weeks ago and last week.
Wow. Did that surprise you, or were you expecting that you would see quite a bit of an increase?
Yeah, I mean, because the temperatures got so warm, we all thought, well, we better get out there and look. And our suspicions were confirmed, indeed, that those warm temperatures brought the ticks out to what we call quest for food. You know, they're out and they're hungry after being sequestered for the winter. So not terribly surprising, but it is sort of upsetting, right? Because it's just so early, Kate.
What usually happens to ticks during the winter months?
You know, ticks have literally a really thick skin and and even some proteins in their bodies that are like antifreeze. And they're really, really cold tolerant and really clever about getting away from the cold. And so during the winter months, they'll sort of nestle down in leaf litter and be underneath the snow cover. And by being in those places and having those sort of bodily adaptations to the cold, ticks can really resist some pretty extreme temperatures.
But you know, when the snow is melted and there isn't that much you know, that many great places to hide, what if we do get that hard freeze in coming weeks? What might that do to the tick population?
I think it's a really interesting dilemma for the ticks to have it be such that there really isn't a snow cover out there at this point. It could be dangerous to the ticks, but again, they're so well adapted to the cold that we know that they can kind of tuck away if they can find some leaf litter, and they'll probably make it through. Although I think with these kinds of radical shifts in temperatures, we have some inspiration to do some more research to see what this kind of roller coaster of temperature experiences is going to do to the ticks.
Talking with Lyric Bartholomew, who is a professor in the Department of Pathobiological Sciences at UW-Madison, examining the warmer winter's effects on ticks and other insects that carry disease. Call in with a question. You can share your comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So, Lyric, if ticks are active earlier in the year, will their populations perhaps grow larger than is typical in a year?
You know, ticks have this kind of weird life cycle. It's different from what we see with insects. And so the ticks that we're seeing now and we'll see in the coming months are ticks that have actually been out in the environment for already like a year or more. And so I think our total starting numbers of ticks are set. And I'm not sure that we'll see large increases in numbers. I think the danger, Kate, is that what we're seeing already is that the ticks are active at a time when we wouldn't expect them to be. So maybe not more numbers of ticks, but more activity of those ticks sooner in the year could be problematic.
It makes me think about how the changing climate may be more hospitable to the tick's life cycle.
Yeah, absolutely. And to other species of ticks that could make their way into the state and get established.
Right, because there are other types of ticks. I mean, we think about the deer tick, the black-legged tick that we're familiar with up here, but there's the Lone Star tick, and there are others, you know, besides that. Will other ticks besides the deer tick start becoming more prevalent here?
I think it's a real possibility. Absolutely. We know that the Lone Star tick has made its way progressively northward in the states south of us. And we have some records of that tick getting to Wisconsin, but it seems like it hasn't established yet. But these sort of warmer winters may provide much more hospitable habitat for those ticks to really invade and get established here in the state.
So when you and your colleagues head out into the field and you drag that net behind you, and you gather up all of that leaf litter and ticks here and there, what do you do with the ticks that you find?
So some of the ticks that we find, we would just sort of look at right there in the space where we're doing the work, see what's present. And typically we'll put them in a vial and bring them back to the lab. Sometimes we bring them back and actually test them for tick-borne pathogens to see whether that's a risk. I think at this point in the year, we were just really looking to see if they were there or not.
I wonder, are ticks becoming better at finding their hosts? Are they adapting? Are they mutating? Do you see any evolution in them?
Well, that's fun to think about. I don't think we've seen that yet. I think what will be interesting, Kate, is to see as we get these warmer winters, how ticks might adapt to the presence or absence of the things they need to be feeding on and whether those things are out there. So a tick has to be out in a way that it coincides with when mice are active, for example. And so so all of those things will have to kind of coalesce in order for the ticks to survive. And ticks and pathogens like ticks are just notorious for adaptation. So so we could be seeing some interesting things in the future.
UW-Madison Professor Lyric Bartholomew studies insect-borne diseases as we discuss this historically warm winter in Wisconsin and the outlook for tick activity. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts along the way at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. With this mild winter we're having, we explore whether the tick season may start earlier, and could it be a bad one if the tick population isn't dying off from freezing temperatures? Call in with a question. You can share your perspective at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Lyric Bartholomew, who's a professor in the Department of Pathobiological Sciences at UW-Madison. Let's go to Doug in Lansing, Iowa. Doug, hi.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
And my first comment is I looked out the window and the bluebirds are back.
Ah, okay. There's a sign. Go ahead.
Yeah, and secondly, the ticks have been back in northeast Iowa, just across the river. I live in Lansing for like 2 or 3 weeks. If you want to find out where the ticks are, the vets I talked to said they're everywhere. Mm. And I've been treating my cats because cats get ticks around the neck that they can't get rid of. They're very good elsewhere in the body. And my cats came in like 2 weeks ago, and they were just covered with ticks. everywhere.
Okay. So that was an indicator there. Yes. Do you have a specific question?
No, I'm just saying that when they drag them, it's really great, but they
the pets are a better indicator.
I called the vet. She said, "We have the medication. Everybody's flocking in to get tick medication for their pets."
well, Lyric, I think I see some budding scientists here in the cat that comes in with those ticks.
That's right. You know, Kate, that's really fun that you called in, Doug, to tell us about the bluebirds and made such an important point about our animal friends. I'm actually part of the School of Veterinary Medicine here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And I used to work at Iowa State University, and we ran a program where we asked people to send us their ticks, and folks from Northeast Iowa often sent us their ticks from cats, actually. So it's interesting to have that come full circle. But the bottom line is, it's a really important reminder for folks that it's time to make the call to your veterinarian and make sure that your friends, your furry friends, are on tick prevention. So, you know, there are a variety of ways that you could do that. There are a number of different products. My little dog actually got Lyme from a tick bite a couple of years back, and it was really terrible on her body. So we saw full force the impact of ticks and tick-borne diseases on our animals and my family. So thank you for that reminder, Doug.
Doug, thanks for the call. Speaking of Lyme disease, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reports that Lyme is the most common illness spread by ticks, with almost 500,000 people diagnosed with it every year. Is there a time of year when ticks are more likely to carry diseases like Lyme disease?
Yeah, well, so ticks are carrying Lyme all of their lives. They actually contract the bacteria that cause Lyme disease when they're in their sort of first life stage, called a larva. So they're out there and infected. And in Wisconsin, we know that, let's say, roughly sort of 20% of the ticks at any given time are infected with Lyme bacteria. The danger, I think, that we're seeing this year is that everybody expects Lyme to be a problem in like June or so, Kate, when the ticks that are most likely to transmit Lyme disease, the nymph stage, are out and active. And those ticks are really, really tiny and hard to find on your body, and often go, as I said, undetected. And so if they feed on you for a significant amount of time, then they can transmit Lyme bacteria. And then, you know, we get potentially really sick, like my dog Moxie and lots of Wisconsinites have. So I think the danger this year is that those ticks might be out and active sooner. And if we would normally in a typical year expect to see people getting Lyme in June, could be this year that shifts earlier. And that would be unexpected. That'd be unexpected for the people to whom it's happening, and also potentially to their healthcare providers. Mm-hmm. And so I think we need to be alerted to this really important issue, that there could be ticks out, that we need to do tick prevention for ourselves, for our pets, and that we might see more people getting sick sooner in the year as a result of these warm temperatures.
What are some tick prevention tips for people who are heading outdoors?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I wish it was as simple for us as getting to put on a collar or take a pill like we can for our pets. but for humans, it's more complicated. And so we have to be really vigilant. We recommend things like using, if you're outdoors a lot, using the products that you can actually spray on your clothes and have your clothes sort of made anti-tick for multiple washes. That's a spray that you can pick up at a hardware store to treat your clothes. You can also buy clothes from outdoor stores that are treated with these sort of anti-tick chemicals that will keep the ticks off of you. If you prefer something that's a little more temporary and just want something that you could use on a given day for a Saturday hike, You could use a repellent, so something that has, for example, DEET in it would be a really good option to spray on yourself and your clothes according to the label. We also recommend that you could, tuck your pants into your socks and wear clothes that make it easy for you to see ticks. So if you'd wear like khaki or light colored clothes, then if a tick is crawling on your pants, you might be able to see it more readily. So
Sure.
using repellents, right? Like making it so you can see the ticks. And then, Kate, really importantly, we recommend that if you're out and about in places where you've been around ticks before and you know there are ticks, it's really wise to come in, take off those clothes that you had on outdoors, and take a shower and use a loofah or use a washcloth and scrub your skin, get the any ticks off of you that way. And ideally also really check yourself or have a friend check you for ticks so that you know they're not hiding on you.
We have Lyric Bartholomew with us, professor in the Department of Pathobiological Sciences at UW-Madison, as we discuss the warmer winter's effect on ticks and other insects that carry disease. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Lyric, there's been some hope. There's been some advancement in creating a Lyme disease vaccine for people. Will that, do you think, become a reality at any point?
We're really hopeful. The federal funding agencies have invested a lot in bringing a vaccine back for Lyme disease, and I think we'll start to see more about that in the next couple of years. I know there have been clinical trials for that ongoing, even here in Wisconsin last year. So hopefully we're on a fast track to getting access to a safe vaccine for folks to prevent Lyme.
In terms of other other insects and disease spreading, what is the condition that you might predict with mosquitoes in the coming season?
Yeah, so I think, every time warm temperatures arise, we think about ticks and mosquitoes. So I'm really glad you brought that up, Kate. I think we really can't adequately probably predict what's going to happen with all 53 or so species of mosquito in Wisconsin. But one of the things I've been really interested in is how these fluctuating temperatures in the spring might impact mosquitoes. And the research that we're doing in my lab shows that it's pr actually pretty stressful on a mosquito that's out there. It's supposed to be, in this state of rest, but if it's exposed to warm temperatures and then cold temperatures and warm temperatures, they can't crawl away like a tick can to protect themselves. And so I think this actually could be pretty stressful on a mosquito and potentially impact the numbers that survive our winters.
Makes me also wonder about our drought conditions in our state, and being extremely dry, that might also affect them.
Absolutely, it does. And so we know that there has to be water to support the juvenile stages of mosquitoes to be out there in the environment. That said, as I said with ticks too, we kind of have to bet on these bloodsuckers and pathogens having clever ways to get around adversity. And so, some of the mosquitoes that really rely on water, they have eggs that are really resistant and are out there in the environment just waiting for a flood. So, I don't think we can bet on them being gone at all. But I think we have to get ready for change.
In our last moments together, in your research on ticks and mosquitoes, what more are you trying to learn?
Yeah, we're really trying to do everything we can to understand how to best prevent people from getting bitten by ticks and mosquitoes that could transmit things like Lyme disease and West Nile virus. So we're looking at how we can better control them, how we can come up with ways to talk about ticks and mosquitoes that might inspire people to change their behaviors and wear that repellent or do that tick check after they've been outdoors. We're working with companies and with mosquito control districts to understand like protect people at the community level from mosquitoes and ticks. So we'd welcome you to come on over to the Midwest Center of Excellence for Vector-Borne Disease site and learn more about the work we're doing.
Well, Lyric, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, as always, for having me, Kate. It's always nice to hear you and get to talk to you.
Oh, likewise. Lyric Bartholomew is a professor in the Department of Pathobiological Sciences at UW-Madison, co-directs its Midwest Center of Excellence for Vector-Borne Diseases. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Scientists are still learning about the long-term health effects of e-cigarettes on children and teens. A Wisconsin pediatric lung specialist joins us to discuss the risks in vaping. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a Madison business owner. It's part of a series we're airing this month on women in southern Wisconsin in partnership with Midwest Mujeres.
Angela Morgan of Madison was feeling uninspired in her job a few years back. It was too rigid.
I actually was used to working in customer service, so I was always in an office, always on a phone, always behind a desk, and I was like, this does not fit my life, this does not fit my personality, and I miss my kids, you know?
Morgan says she decided to take a huge risk. She started her own business, Food Junkies Catering. Morgan considers herself an eclectic chef. She'll make anything for her customers. Beef, fish, vegan dishes. But Morgan's favorite meal to cater?
Tacos.
Who doesn't love a taco?
Exactly.
They make everyone so happy.
And they come in so many different variations, right? Mm-hmm. Like, actually, that was the first thing that I started selling was jerk chicken tacos. And then I noticed, like, you're making, like, $400 a day. So it's a staple in my business, the jerk chicken tacos and a jerk chicken salad. So those are the two things that people are, like, running me down in the street about.
I talked with Morgan about this as part of a storytelling partnership with Midwest Mujeres in Madison. After making me very hungry for tacos, Morgan told me more about what drives her in her work and in her personal life.
My motto for life, people and things will come and go. Always stay true to you. I started this business to generate extra income, be creative, and to spend more time with my children. Plot twist, I didn't see much of them for the first 2 years.
But now, business is consistent for Morgan, and she sees her daughters more often.
I have two daughters named Cameron and Zora. My daughters are my rocks and my headaches. I absolutely love them.
Morgan says they appreciate what she does and help her out with catering.
Being a mother and a business owner has taught me balance. As they grow, I am showing them and teaching them what it means to sacrifice, to work hard, to watch your money, and to have fun. My ultimate dream for them is to use my work ethic to follow their own dreams, because this one's mine.
She says Food Junkie's success has had a positive impact on her family.
They're so proud of me. That's been the biggest thing. We've had a challenging life, you know, being a single parent, having to move around, you know, not really having the support that we needed. And so for them to look at me now like that, like a local celebrity, is like, oh, mom's that girl.
And now the mother and daughters are working on another project together, a family and friends cookbook.
Well, my daughter just turned 21, and she's always talking to me about her generation and how they don't really have what our generation had, right? They're not standing in the kitchen with us watching grandma cook, so they're like, can you put us together a cookbook or something, like something that's really simple that we can make good meals? They're young parents. They want to feed their kids good food.
And Morgan will keep feeding her customers. She dreams of expanding Food Junkies Catering, adding barbecue, or one day owning a food truck.
I see nothing but great things in the future for myself and for my children. Just making sure I'm sticking to my guns, that my mindset is always where it needs to be, and that I have enough courage to execute what I know. So I'm good.
Angela Morgan shared her story with us as part of a partnership with Midwest Mujeres in Madison. We've partnered with the organization to share stories of women who live in southern Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast and find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says e-cigarettes are unsafe for kids, teens, and young adults. And young people who vape may be more likely to smoke cigarettes in the future. We meet a Wisconsin physician who shares these concerns in a documentary series called Big Vape, investigating the e-cigarette maker Juul. Call in with a question. You can share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Luella Amos is a pediatric pulmonologist at Children's Wisconsin and an associate professor of pediatrics at Medical College of Wisconsin. Dr. Amos, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
Why do teens vape?
So that's a very loaded question, I would say. You know, back in 2014, that was kind of when cigarettes, you know, traditional cigarettes were somewhat popular, like 1 in 10 students were smoking. But then they switched to e-cigarettes around that time just because they're a little bit more discreet. It doesn't hurt as much in the throat, and they can get a lot more nicotine through certain e-cigarette products at that time. So it was a very popular device, and they could do it, you know, in the home without anyone knowing it and in school.
So that's 2014, progressed to 2019. You're seeing lung injuries, and there is a rash of concern out there that the e-cigarettes are really causing harm. What have you noticed in the trends in the 5 years since the lung injury outbreak?
So as we all know, there was the COVID-19 pandemic of essentially 2020 when we shut down. So hospitalizations related to lung injury definitely decreased. I can't say that vaping decreased, but people were sort of made aware of the effects of e-cigarettes, especially vaping THC, which seemed to be a major culprit in these lung injuries. So I would say hospitalizations decreased, but vaping itself did not.
Can you explain a little bit more about the marijuana concentrate in this highly potent concentrated form of THC? What's going on there?
So back in 2019, we discovered that there were THC cartridges, also known as carts, being distributed throughout the country, honestly. And they contained a cutting agent called vitamin E acetate, which had the same viscosity as THC oil. And this is a way that people could sell and distribute THC in cartridges for much cheaper. And so what we discovered was that you're not supposed to inhale vitamin E acetate oil because it causes a significant lung injury, pneumonia, and potentially death in if it's inhaled in a e-cigarette.
The marijuana concentrates, they contain really high THC levels, and this manufactured marijuana in the potency that is going into these types of cartridges and these e-cigarettes.
What are the concerns there? What are you seeing?
So the thing with vaping THC is that you kind of alluded to this, is that you can get a high concentration of the psychoactive ingredient of cannabis, which is THC, into the body, and it's not well received. You know, you can get pretty toxic levels, much higher than smoking marijuana, you know, through a joint or something like that. And so you get a very quick high. You get you can get significant nausea and vomiting. Some of the kids had severe weight loss, like 20 to 40 pounds weight loss over a month, because of this, the GI or the gastro intestinal effects of THC vaping, outside of the lung injury that it was causing. And it was, you know, potentially indolent, where they were starting to develop shortness of breath, doing normal activities of daily living.
The legal age to buy vapes and e-cigarettes is 21. How are kids getting their hands on these devices?
So yeah, in 2019, federal law was passed to raise the age of tobacco product purchase from 18 to 21, also known as Tobacco 21. However, state law also needs to be congruent with federal law so that retail partners and law enforcement can actually enforce this federal law. The issue is that Wisconsin state law still has it at 18. It hasn't quite passed, which is kind of ironic since Wisconsin was the first to sort of discover the lung injury, or at least go public with it, back in 2019.
The Netflix recently coming out with a docuseries on the vaping industry, Big Vape, and it says that the manufacturer Juul was created to help adults quit smoking tobacco, but marketed its products directly to teens. How big of a role does marketing have in teen vaping?
It's huge. I mean, we know what social media does, you know, to teens. They're on it all the time, and that's what they see, and that's what attracts them. So if it looks like a really cool thing to do, the people vaping are, you know, good looking, thin, you know, just very attractive people. This is something that they'll kind of gravitate to. Also, you know, marketing flavors. That's a very appealing thing. I mean, majority of kids who vape will only vape if it's flavored, not the menthol necessarily, or just the tobacco taste. They want the flavors,
like the tutti frutti flavors. Mm-hmm. That you would think that would be very much a child type target, right?
Absolutely. I mean, adults like it too, but kids definitely will gravitate towards the flavors.
The World Health Organization wants a ban on flavored vapes, similar to how flavored cigarettes are controlled. And the opponents to stricter vape regulation say it would reinforce misunderstandings about the risks of vaping. What do you make of this argument against tighter vape regulations around flavors?
I am in favor of it. You know, kind of going back to the initial intent, we think that Juul had to kind of curb traditional cigarette smoking. You know, if you really want to quit smoking cigarettes, you really should not care about the flavor. You know, you kind of want to switch to a different device, kind of like nicotine patches, nicotine gum, and e-cigarettes. You know, they do contain nicotine. It's just a replacement, but the flavors are dangerous. You know, it's a fine line of kind of reeling in the wrong population to use these devices. And so I feel strongly that if you really want to quit smoking cigarettes and you're willing to use e-cigarettes to do that, I feel that the flavors should really not play a role.
Dr. Luella Amos with us, pediatric pulmonologist at Children's Wisconsin, as we examine the risks of e-cigarettes to lung function in kids and teens. Be part of the discussion at any point. Call in with a question. You can bring your perspective at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We talk with a Children's Wisconsin pediatric pulmonologist about the harmful effects of vaping. Dr. Luella Amos is here, was interviewed for a Netflix docuseries called Big Vape. Here's a moment from that trailer.
I don't think anyone could have anticipated how many children would want this product. People at Juul were sending out free products to a long list of influencers and celebrities. When you put something like the Juul campaign out into the world, it's like releasing a genie from a bottle.
Colin, with a question, you can share comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Mark in Caledonia. Mark, hi.
Hi. I just wanted the guest and you to know that, and maybe your guest already knows this, but that phenomenon she was talking about where people lose their appetite and lose weight and feel nauseous, that can happen to anybody that smokes regularly. It doesn't have to be from vaping. I've seen people complain about their appetite and they're losing weight. And then when they slack off on the marijuana or give it up, it changes and they gain weight and everything gets back to normal. So it's the THC that can do that. It isn't necessarily vaping only. I can see where it would be worse with vaping because of the concentrations they're getting, especially if they do it regularly.
Mark, thank you for the call. Dr. Amos, what are the effects, whether it is nausea or the effects on major organs and the brain?
You know, I think I completely agree with that. You know, the different ways to consume or, use THC. You can eat it, you can smoke it, you can vape it. But what we do notice is that the way that e-cigarettes have been used to vape THC, the concentration is much higher than you would get with a joint. There's a lot lost in the side stream smoke. And so, you know, to be able to titrate it, you know, to kind of wait and see, you know, okay, I can use a little bit more to get the high or whatever. You kind of get the high quickly, at least the way that these cartridges have been working for the teens themselves. Like, they're out, you know, after just a little bit of use, they can't even function potentially wherever they're using it. You know, they pass out or they feel sick right away.
Let's bring in Jim in Kenosha now. Jim, hi.
Yes, I got a quick experience, and then I want a question about the medical THC. My sister-in-law actually died from the vaping disease. It really is harmful, that vitamin E viscosity that cannot flush out of the lungs. She got on oxygen for years. It got so worse, she became a recipient for lung. She suffered with the lung transplant. She was on a good trajectory, but after a year, she passed last August. And she actually was trying to get away from a medication that was addictive, and it was my understanding she was prescribed it. And my question is, do they still have THC prescribed for pain management that's vaping?
Dr. Amos?
Yes, thank you for that question, and I am so sorry about your family member. You know, From what I have learned, at least, you know, on the adult side, perhaps they have been, and I don't know in this state if they are prescribing it, but in children, not, no, they are not. They may be using it in a way for the anorexia caused by chemotherapy, potentially, just to kind of help with appetite. In children, but that's really, it's not obviously going to be vaped. It's going to be consumed. Given that way and not inhaled. So long and short, I don't think so. I am not sure about this state, potentially other states. Yes.
With vaping and serious vaping, Dr. Amos, how resilient are the teens' lungs? How much can they recover in lung function?
Yeah, so it's a very, very good question. There's a range, I would say. In those teens who have suffered lung injury, the ones who have come back to see me in follow-up or see any of our pulmonologists in follow-up, there's a reason why they're still in follow-up. It's because they still have symptoms. And the symptoms are very nonspecific. It could be chest pain. It could be shortness of breath with activity that they normally would not have had issues with in the past. But when we do imaging like chest x-rays, chest CTs, or look at pulmonary function tests and other forms of objective information, there really doesn't seem to be residual disease. However, subjectively, they don't feel the same. So it's very hard to treat something that's not tangible. We don't know exactly why they feel the way they do. But that's kind of what we're experiencing now, unfortunately.
So much to learn there, so much to research. Dr. Luella Amos with us, pediatric pulmonologist at Children's Wisconsin. Let's go to Alec in Milwaukee. Alec, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. Go ahead.
So I just caught the conversation. I love the conversation. It's actually really relevant to us right now. I actually work in a high school, and I'm a Spanish teacher, and this is something we've been battling. So, the past 2 years, it's been really difficult for us, trying to get it out of the schools, but also trying to get the kids informed. And one of the things I wanted to maybe see if the speaker could talk to is the fact of just the accessibility or the size of these vapes. And I'm not sure if it's changed over time. This is kind of new to us. You know, we're kind of getting caught up in it. And so, you know, it's tough for us, because it's like the size of a lighter or a small tube of lipstick. And so, you know, getting a hold of it can be so hard for us, and getting track of it, because the students, you know, all it takes is we'll find it in a pencil pouch. And so it's hard, but we're learning to try to push the education on them. And we just held a little seminar last week in the gym. So, you know, we're trying our best.
Alec, thank you for calling in. Dr. Amos.
Alec, yeah, I applaud you and your educators for trying to learn about it. I think that is the first step, and it's vital. You've got to learn about e-cigarettes. You've got to be able to recognize it so you can, know if it's going on and where it's going on. That is, even for parents, it's very important to be able to know what one looks like and know what one could smell like. Because they will be doing it in the rooms, in the bathrooms, at the home, in the school. And that's the first thing that you need to do. You also kind of need to know the symptoms of it. So we talked about some of the symptoms of vaping THC, nausea, vomiting, weight loss, shortness of breath, chest pain. Nicotine withdrawal is another thing to kind of keep track of, because they can look, you know, teenagers may be irritable in general, but more irritability, restlessness, inability to concentrate, sweating, because they can actually withdraw, overnight, 8 hours of no vaping.
Well, Dr. Amos,
they can definitely have symptoms like that.
Dr. Amos, thank you for joining us.
No problem. Thank you so much for having this conversation.
Dr. Luella Amos, pediatric pulmonologist at Children's Wisconsin, associate professor of pediatrics at Medical College of Wisconsin. And for disclosure, Medical College of Wisconsin is a business sponsor of WPR. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about the potential for incinerating garbage to recover energy. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency identifies two municipal waste combustors in Wisconsin among dozens nationwide. And one is the Barron County Waste Energy Facility in the northwestern part of the state. Call in with a question. You can share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Lauren Wentz is a biology professor at UW-Eau Claire-Barron County campus, teaching an incinerator operator course through the State Department of Natural Resources. Lauren, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate.
Well, let's
start. Good morning.
Good morning. Let's start with some definitions here. How do you talk about and define waste incineration?
Waste incineration is, it's pretty much what it sounds like, burning trash. There are different types of trash, and probably the form that most people deal with is municipal solid waste. which is generated from homes and businesses and schools. And in parts of the country and here in Northwest Wisconsin, much of that municipal solid waste is incinerated.
At what temperature is it incinerated? How high does it go to burn trash?
Well, it depends on the structure of the incinerator. But using the Barron County facility as an example, there are two combustion chambers. The first one is where most of the burning occurs of the solid materials that are in the waste stream. That one operates at temperatures around 800 to 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit. The secondary chamber at this facility will operate at temperatures of about 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit, but it's burning mostly gases at that point.
And then going from the first chamber to the second chamber, how does the trash move or what it becomes? Mm-hmm. I mean, through the process, it seems to be shrinking down and shrinking down the waste.
Yeah, that's correct. There's a loading port or pit, if you will, where the actual waste is put into the primary chamber. And it moves along. There will already be a fire established there, but it moves along on a moving grate. As ash forms, the ash filters out through the grate. And by the time the initial load of trash is at the end of that chamber, it's almost entirely ash and gases. So the gases rise up, go into the secondary chamber. The ash falls out the bottom and then is periodically collected for further disposal.
Is that what they call fly ash?
Well, there are three different types of ash that can occur during incineration. So bottom ash is the ash that falls through the grate as the trash is burned. And that's moved along on a conveyor as well. There, fly ash, if you think of like a campfire mm-hmm. in your backyard and you see the little sparks fly up into the air,
yep.
those are fly ash. And so there will be some of that that will be collected and passed through the system, eventually to be filtered out. But then there's also fugitive ash, and that's the type of ash that you don't want. Because it's ash that basically is uncontained. So there are methods or procedures in place to avoid the release of fugitive ash, especially from the accumulated bottom ash pile that is eventually disposed of in a landfill.
Does it have to go to a special landfill with this ash, or how is it disposed of?
According to U.S. EPA regulations, any bottom ash, fly ash, or other debris left over from the incineration process must go to a landfill, and it has to go to a special section, a monofill section of that landfill, where the only thing that's taken care of is the ash itself.
Lauren Wentz is with us, professor of biology at UW-Eau Claire-Barron County, as we talk about the process of waste incineration in Wisconsin. Call in with questions and comments along the way at 800-642-1234. So, Lauren, which materials can be incinerated at the Barron County waste-to-energy facility?
Almost anything from a municipal solid waste stream. There are regulations in place in Wisconsin that will say things like recyclable materials, yard waste, lead acid batteries, tires, or waste oil cannot be burned in an incinerator. But the Barron County facility, because it is... I had notes on this. It has energy recovery
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
from the incineration process. There are DNR makes exceptions for that, or the state of Wisconsin regulations make exceptions, and they are allowed to burn tires, recyclables, and yard waste as those occur in the waste stream. Lead acid batteries are a no-go. And similarly, appliances, white goods, as they're called collectively, cannot be incinerated.
How does the waste-to-energy facility ensure items that can't be incinerated, that they don't get into the process, that they aren't burned?
They are generally pretty good at screening materials as they come in. Of course, part of that depends on the refuse collectors who are also picking things up off the curb. For example, if someone came in with a pickup truck full of miscellaneous furniture, tires, whatever, all of that material would be screened up front to make sure there were no car batteries, for instance, in there. Those items can be accepted at the incinerator, but they can't be burned, the batteries specifically. Tires, though, are fine. And white goods can be recycled as well. And of course, there's a tipping fee for people who bring in large items like that, so that the facility then can pass them on to recycling facilities that deal with white goods or batteries and so on.
How is the cost to incinerate a material determined? What goes into that?
Part of it is labor and the difficulty of recycling an item. Tipping fees are usually per pound, although there are some that are specific for certain items like mattresses. Mattresses are the bane of an incinerator operator's existence.
Why is that?
Because they're big and bulky, they won't fit easily into the combustion chamber, so they have to be torn down. And I just learned from the manager at the Barron facility that they're going to acquire a waste shredder that will help deal with mattresses in particular. They burn just fine, but they can't fit into the chamber. So they're working on making it more feasible to actually burn mattresses at the facility as opposed to sending them out to a recycler.
We have biology professor at UW Eau Claire Barron County campus, Lauren Wentz, with us, teaches an incinerator operator course. Call in with a question. You can share your perspective, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency describes energy recovery from garbage as converting waste that can't be recycled into usable heat, electricity, or fuel through a variety of processes, including combustion. We learn about waste-to-energy incineration here in Wisconsin, and you can call in with a question or share comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Lauren Wentz is here, a biology professor at UW Eau Claire Barron County campus, teaches a course for incinerator operators. Lauren, the Barron County facility says the incineration process causes steam. How does the facility create steam energy?
Sorry about that. It's the heat of combustion that heats water that is circulated through a boiler system, and as that water is heated at very high temperature, it turns into steam. The steam itself can be routed in two different directions, both of which are forms of energy. One is to send it through a condensing steam turbine, which in the process of the turbine operating generates electricity directly on site at the facility. That can then be sent out to the grid, and I believe Xcel Energy purchases the electricity generated from our facility. The other form of energy, of course, is the heat from the steam itself. And that is actually distributed both on site at the incinerator facility to heat the working spaces. And it's also sent across the street to the Saputo Cheese Factory, where the cheesemakers there use it both to heat buildings and as part of the cheesemaking process.
Oh, wow. That's really interesting.
Yeah. Saputo is the world's largest producer of blue cheese, and it just happens to have that factory right across the street from our incinerator.
And so the plant burns a solid waste to heat mm-hmm. water, to generate steam. The steam mm-hmm. then drives like this electric generator turbines?
Yes, a turbine and then a generator, yes.
Okay. And then that can be sent to the grid or across the street to help make cheese.
in this case, the electricity goes to the grid,
uh-huh.
But the steam itself, the actual steam, gets piped across the street to help make cheese.
Wow. Huh. So, you know, in terms of the pollutants, what are some mm-hmm. of the new and modern air pollution control equipment that mm-hmm. might be on these types of facilities?
Mm-hmm. There are a number of different air pollution control devices on site at an incinerator facility, and those are all required by both federal and state regulations. So there will be equipment that will deal, for example, with mercury. As mercury vaporizes during the combustion process, it's combined with activated carbon that essentially neutralizes the mercury. And that will be filtered out through the filtration process later, farther down the line. But it goes into the ash that then is disposed of in the monofill at the landfill. There are neutralizers for acid gases. So, for example, gases that contain sulfur or nitrogen compounds. And that's simply a matter of adding lime mm-hmm. Or a material called trona, which is essentially the same as lime. Then there are filtration systems. And at the Barron County facility, that includes what's known as a bag house, which essentially is like a large vacuum cleaner. It has dozens of individual fabric stacks, and when it's operated under negative pressure, the bag house works just like a vacuum cleaner would in your home to remove particulate matter from the gas stream, so that ultimately as the gas itself passes through all of the air pollution control devices. It's monitored, so there's an emissions monitoring system as well. But by the time it gets to the stack where the remaining gas is vented off, the only thing coming out of the stack is carbon dioxide, water, and the original nitrogen gas that came in with the air that moves through the system. So, and nitrogen gas is 78% of our atmosphere, so it goes in one end, comes out the other, and is not harmful to us in any way. But CO2 and water are the final end products of the entire process.
What happens to the wastewater in the process?
That is collected, and it will be. It can be treated at a wastewater treatment facility.
We're talking about waste incineration with Professor of Biology Lauren Wentz at UW-Eau Claire-Barron County. Call in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Boa is here in Green Bay. Hi, Boa. Go ahead.
Good morning. I had a question. I wanted to find out how much tonnage of waste is burnt, you know, hourly, a day, or even a month, just to kind of get an idea of how much waste is taken off, you know, the community by using this system. And unfortunately, I just thought of another question, if you don't mind me adding, is what is the cost for a city to put up a system like you're describing?
Great questions, both. Thank you. First on the tonnage per hour per day, what is possible, and then costs of creating, building one of these facilities.
Well, I have statistics about the Barron County facility, which according to federal and state regulations is considered a small facility. A small facility, according to federal regulations, burns between 35 and 250 tons per day. But the Barron County facility last year, for the entire year, burned about 41,000 tons of municipal solid waste. They are permitted through the DNR to burn up to 100 tons per day, which means that the incinerator operates 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And each of the two primary chambers that they have two side-by-side primary chambers. Each of those two is loaded with about 100 to 150 pounds of trash every 8 to 10 minutes or so, 24 hours a day.
Is it just the local trash for Barron County, or what distances might this municipal trash be traveling?
It could be traveling from as far away as Superior, Wisconsin, or as far south as, say, Hudson. So essentially the northwest corner of the state, and there may even be a few materials coming in across the Minnesota border.
In terms of looking at the costs of putting one mm-hmm. online, what do you mm-hmm. see there?
In the millions of dollars. Right now, the Barron County facility is undergoing an expansion to accommodate new air pollution control equipment. And I know that that is a multi-million dollar project just for that aspect of the incinerator itself. So it would depend on the amount of trash that would be burned and, you know, the size of the facility, that sort of thing. But it will be in the tens of millions of dollars, I'm certain, to build something new.
Do you have any, like, history there on how Barron County came to have one or how it was able to afford one?
I don't know about the affordability question, mm-hmm. But the facility itself has been in existence since 1986. It went through significant upgrades within the last, I want to say, 15 years or so. It's now, in full compliance with all state regulations regarding emissions and waste handling and that sort of thing. So it's been around, but it's been continuously upgraded and improved over the years.
Where else in Wisconsin are these waste incinerators?
The only other facility in the state of Wisconsin that deals with municipal solid waste is in La Crosse, at the French Island facility owned by Xcel Energy. It is a slightly different layout as incinerators go. It's considered a refuse-derived fuel facility where they take in the solid waste but convert it to a pelletized form that can then be burned and used to generate energy in the form of steam or electricity.
Okay. We have biologist Lauren Wentz with us, created a course for Wisconsin operators of solid waste combustors that is approved by the State Department of Natural Resources. As we discuss aspects of burning trash, about incinerators, be part of this discussion. Call in with the question, what comes up for you? What are your thoughts? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Waste combustion facilities are located in the village of Elmina, Barron County, and La Crosse on the Minnesota border. That is from an Environmental Protection Agency nationwide map of municipal waste combustors. We explore environmental impacts and management of waste energy combustors, and you can be part of the conversation. Call in with a question, add comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Lauren Wentz is a biology professor at UW-Eau Claire Barron County campus, teaches a course for operators of incinerators. Let's bring in Mike in Madison now. Hi, Mike.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call. So I'm curious about the products such as Milorganite and Metro-Grow. Madison has Metro-Grow, Milorganites in Milwaukee. They take human waste streams and create a fertilizer out of it for use in farming and in home applications. And I'm curious about the various pharmaceuticals, the cancer drugs that are in the waste streams. Do those remain intact? Is there some process that they go through that breaks down all of those very complicated compounds that humans are taking, the thousands of different pharmaceuticals? I would think they would still end up in the waste stream. And if it's simply an organism breakdown of the human waste stream, then I don't see how those would be dissipated or destroyed before they are put onto farm fields and applied to people's lawns and crops.
Mike, thank you for the call. And I think it also veers toward medical waste combustion. Lauren, go ahead.
Well, it does and it doesn't. The production of, for example, Milorganite is a byproduct of the wastewater treatment process, not an incineration process. So the degree to which any pharmaceuticals or other, you know, residual organic compounds could be removed from Milorganite depends on the wastewater treatment process. If the same material, the biosolids from wastewater treatment, were to be incinerated, there wouldn't be an issue. Those compounds would be completely destroyed at the high temperatures that incinerators operate at. However, handling biosolid waste requires a specific configuration of an incinerator. There is a biosolids incinerator in Green Bay. They don't handle trash at all. They simply handle the biosolids from the wastewater treatment process. So it's a slightly different end product, I suppose, in terms of the waste management process itself.
So Steve in Black River Falls called in to say that they think burning trash is the best way to get rid of garbage. Landfills, Steve says, tend to leak and pollute groundwater. Trash combustion, though, accounts for such a small portion of our country's waste management strategy. I mean, if you look at the map of the EPA, there are just dozens of these facilities. Why is burying garbage in landfills still the dominant strategy?
I wish I knew the answer to that. We know that land, the space, is an extremely limited resource, and landfills do have lifespans. For example, the Lake Area Landfill in Sorona, which is just north of Rice Lake, has an expected lifespan of about 35 more years before it's full. And at that point, it would either need to be expanded by acquisition of additional land or closed and monitored for a long period of time after closure. So landfills are governed by federal and state regulations in terms of their operation. Some of them do recover energy from the methane that accumulates during decomposition within the landfill, and that can be used as a form of energy, either for electricity production or steam generation as well. But why there aren't more incinerators, I'm not sure. In some places, locating an incinerator for burning municipal solid waste can be problematic. And again, there are federal and state guidelines that determine where an incinerator can be located.
Could the ash that is created and then landfilled, could that be intercepted to be upcycled into something else, like making concrete, for instance?
Yes. Yes, it can. There are a number of products that, and mostly, you know, construction-type products that can be produced from ash, from incinerators, and also from the ash generated by power plants. So it's used for, you know, road material, you know, paving materials, that kind of thing, or landscaping materials.
So that it does have an ability to be used for something, you know, but it's a matter of making that possible and intercepting it before it goes to landfill. Lauren Wentz is with us, professor of biology, UW-Eau Claire-Barron County, as we talk about the process of waste incineration here in Wisconsin and beyond. Call in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Kevin in Madison now. Hi, Kevin. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. I was a film critic in Milwaukee for the Shepherd Express newspaper and the Community Journal newspaper. And when I heard you all talk about incineration, it made me think about the movie Sahara with Steve Zahn, Penelope Cruz, and I always forget his name. All right, all right, all right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But anyway, and what happened was that there was they had a solar powered waste facility in Africa, and an unscrupulous operator was just going to dump the waste into the Atlantic Ocean. It was going to poison the whole west coast of Africa. And I thought about that because there was an exciting sequence where they were they tried to infiltrate the area because of Penelope Cruz. She was a scientist and she was an ecological activist, and they tried to sneak into the thing, and they snuck in one of the automatic bins, and it carried them up to the solar power, and they almost got incinerated and stuff.
So the big screen waste incineration, you know, in movies as well. But Kevin, I think it brings up an important point. Do scientists know enough about the health risks or the ecological risks of being around these plants and the pollution, Lauren?
Yeah, there is constant monitoring of both the emissions and the operation of the equipment within a facility that handles municipal solid waste. Part of an incinerator operator's job is to monitor daily, sometimes hourly, what's happening within the plant, and recording all of the information about emissions and ash accumulation and that sort of thing. So there's very close monitoring of all of the different processes within an incinerator facility. And all of that is reported to the Wisconsin DNR and ultimately to the US EPA. And those records, you know, are kept very, very diligently, because the law says they have to be. So there is an understanding of what kinds of materials may be present, although in a facility that is operating according to federal regulations, the end products of the incineration process are, as I mentioned earlier, CO2 and water vapor, which are not going to, you know, pose a human health threat.
You mentioned, you know, from 1986 with Barron County, there have been, you know, through the decades, a series of upgrades and refinements to this facility, and now a shredder coming online as well. I'm wondering, are these upgrades the result of keeping up with federal requirements, or are these upgrades just because the technology is changing and the county wants to keep up? I mean, what causes a facility to continually change and become better at what it's doing?
Mm-hmm. I would say that probably it's more efficient. Newer equipment, can create digital records of everything instead of a little bit slower paper records, that sort of thing. And of course, storing the data collected on a daily basis is much easier. And of course, there are improvements in the equipment technology itself. In fact, once the expansion, the expansion to accommodate newer air pollution control equipment at Barron County is completed, they'll be able to increase their capacity by 50%.
Wow.
They're currently permitted at 100 tons per day. They'll be able to go up to 150 tons per day and at the same time reduce their emissions by 50%. So the upgrade is making the air pollution control process that much more efficient.
I wonder, you know, as I was reading about this, there are some states like Florida that are really leaning in, gearing up to do more waste combustion in the future. Mm-hmm. What do you think is Wisconsin's trajectory here? I mean, do you hear about more communities wanting to go this route with their trash?
I'm not sure what the situation would be in the state of Wisconsin. Obviously, there are startup costs and there may be, an energy company like Xcel or We Energies that, you know, would look into something like that. As communities go, for, say, a county to establish its own incinerator, cost will be part of the calculation.
Mm-hmm.
And that would need to be, you know, weighed against the cost of expanding a landfill or adding another landfill. So it's certainly the case here in Barron County that the waste incinerator can generate revenue for the county. So part of the reason they're able to do a multi-million-dollar expansion is because of the revenue that's generated from selling the energy that they produce.
Lauren Wentz, creator of a multi-day training course for operators of solid waste combustors in partnership with the Department of Natural Resources. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The State Natural Resources Department estimates Wisconsin generates 4.6 million tons of trash and recyclables each year. How much of that could be incinerated? So we're learning about how waste-to-energy facilities work. Lauren Wentz is a UW-Eau Claire Barron County biology professor, teaches an incinerator operator course. Lauren heard from Deb in Green Bay, called in to ask, what happens when the monitoring system breaks down? What is the backup plan at an incinerator?
Mm-hmm. If a monitoring system should go offline temporarily, it is possible to stop the incineration process. It's a process, so it may take several hours to do that. But the incinerator can be shut down and the problem rectified, and then the facility can be fired up again once the situation is corrected.
Let's bring in Gary in Duluth. Gary, hello. Go ahead.
Yes, the question I had is the mercury content of the waste is what was an issue in Duluth when we had an incinerator here. The WLSSD had to shut down its incinerator because of the mercury emissions that both went up the stack and out in the wastewater with the scrubbers. Many wastes, particularly from hospitals, have mercury content in them. And people throw away things as switches and light bulbs and things like that get incinerated. And the mercury is a major issue for the Duluth area.
Gary, thank you. Yes, thank you for bringing that perspective. Lauren, what about mercury emissions here that are concerning?
Well, anytime mercury shows up in the solid waste stream, of course, it's a concern. But through the air pollution control process, the addition of activated carbon to adsorb the mercury atoms will effectively neutralize the mercury and not make it, and at that point it's unable to get back into the environment in its harmful form. So again, that becomes part of the ash that's collected and disposed of in a monofill at a landfill. There are issues, I mean, there have been issues nationwide and even worldwide with toxic materials like mercury sort of escaping from the incineration process. But in a well-run, well-monitored facility, it's not necessarily a concern. It's monitored, it's controlled, but it's not released into the environment.
Let's turn to your 32-hour course that you teach. Mm-hmm. What type of training must an incinerator operator go through to be certified in Wisconsin?
Well, the 32 hours cover a range of topics from the history of solid waste management to the regulations, both federal and state regulations that govern waste incineration, to how to handle waste. Simply, you know, how do you deal with things like mattresses or tires or construction materials that enter the waste stream. It includes things like how to keep records and working worker safety on the job, risk management on the job. So it's really a gamut of topics, but they all relate to waste incineration.
Have you had to change the course at all since you created it?
Not significantly in terms of the content. That is specified in the Natural Resources Statute 499 in the state of Wisconsin. So there's a list of topics that are required to be covered in the course. But I generally tweak the presentation of those topics a little bit every year just to make it more interesting and more fun.
I would imagine, too, that there are site visits to Barron County as part of the process, as part of the certification?
Yes. So the anyone who takes part in the course will have an opportunity to visit that facility, although some of the students in that course are workers at the Barron County facility already,
okay,
so they kind of
sure.
know their way around.
Who's going to show whom here?
Right. And let me tell you, they can tell me more about the inner workings of the machinery and the equipment there than I could ever hope to tell them. But we've also had students in the course from the Wildlife Research Lab in Madison, several of the hospitals in Madison, and even from French Island, the incinerator in La Crosse, take part in the course in order to get the certification. Even though their facilities may be very different from the Barron County one, the certification through the state DNR is important to the work that they do in those facilities.
What protective clothing do they wear around the incinerator chambers?
Well, It depends on where you are on mm-hmm. the or within the plant, but in any case, obviously reflective vests, just so you can see where people are in what can be a somewhat dark space, and you know, sensible shoes, closed-toed shoes, coveralls, I don't want to say often, but sometimes respirators or masks just to, you know, avoid inhaling dust and debris from the waste pile itself.
Mm-hmm.
So the general personal protective gear that you would encounter in any industrial setting is probably the best way to describe it.
Trista sent along an email asking, what do incinerators use for fuel to operate?
The fuel itself is the trash. So to get it ignited. I actually asked this question of the operators last summer when I taught the course. A lighter, set something on fire, and once you have that going, the trash itself is the fuel for combustion.
Is there any particular order the trash must go in order to keep the chamber a regulated heat setting, to keep the heat at a certain temperature?
Generally, the best idea is to mix it, because different materials have different heating values, as they're called. So, for example, if someone is throwing away a bag full of food waste that can be very wet, right, you want to mix that as much as you can with, say, paper or wood chips or something much drier.
Mm-hmm.
So that you get, as close as you can to a well-mixed fuel load. And that will help things burn more evenly and help maintain the temperatures within the primary chamber at the level they should be maintained.
In our last moments, squeaking in one last question, Tony emailed to ask, do we know the power generation per ton of waste?
Per ton, for the Barron County facility, I cannot give you the, per ton energy generation. But last year, the facility sold about 5,100 megawatts of electricity and generated over 103,000 or 102,000 tons of steam. So, again, that goes into the cheese factory and heating at the plant.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, Lauren, we appreciate you joining us. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It was great fun, Kate.
Lauren Wentz is a biology professor at UW-Eau Claire Barron County campus, teaches an incinerator operator course that we talked about through the State Department of Natural Resources. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.